Hey guys, and welcome to the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. The first podcast to bring you the local fishing report for Alabama's lakes and rivers, whether it's good, bad, or ugly. I'm your host, Nick Williams, and this week's show is brought to you by... All right, guys, welcome back to another week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report. It's hot, but we're starting to get a little bit closer toward fall. Last week, we talked with some of the folks down the Mobile Tensaw Delta. Talked with some folks over on the Tallapoosa. This week, we got Taylor Haar reporting in from the Wiregrass region of the state down in southeast Alabama. Taylor, how you doing?
Hey, Nick. Thanks for having me, man. I'm doing good. How about you?
Man, I cannot complain. The house is quiet. Dog's not bothering me. So I'm just sitting here chilling, knocking out some work.
Yeah, man. You mentioned before we got on here that y'all were having a storm rolling through. We definitely... We need some rain around here. My garden is looking pretty rough about this time of year, and I think the fish over here wouldn't mind a little shower or something as well. We're really low as far as water levels go, so hopefully we can get some kind of rain over here pretty soon.
Yeah, we definitely needed a little shot of rain. My grass was getting pretty crunchy, and it's raining pretty good right now. I reckon it's going to rain for probably 20 minutes and then roll on through, and it won't be we need a good soaking rain. Like, we need a good hour or two of drizzle to really get it good. But yeah, it's the same here. Water's been low. Everybody that we've talked to talking about low water. What's that do for y'all? Like, I know I haven't poked around in that area a lot, but I know we've talked, I did some riding around this summer, and there's a lot of water that people forget about. You got the Spolga, the Kaneka, Pea River, you know, Choctaw Hatchie and all that. And, you know, it varies. Like, the, you know, the Kaneka and the Sepulga are rocky. The section of the Pea that I saw looks sandy. Choctaw Hatchie looks sandy. And of course, you got the Chattahoochee. Are y'all's waters navigable if you're floating when it's this dry, or is it one of them things where you're better off wading, or what's that situation looking like?
Yeah. So it kind of depends, like you said, which of the rivers you're on. Some of those ones that are a bit rockier, you can get away with still floating. And then those ones that are sandy, they don't really have any deep channels through them. So we had discussed, I was out on the Chattahoochee a couple of weeks ago, and we saw a sturgeon out there. But we floated that, but just barely in a canoe. John boat wouldn't make it up there, but... canoe will just barely get you by, but it's not really fishable, the sandy stuff. Some folks go out there and they have like mud motors or a lot of airboats on that stretch. But this time of year, we tend to stick to some of those rockier streams. There's some stuff kind of up a little bit from the state line where you can still get some decent flow and catch some fish.
What you say, some decent flow, is it... What are you catching in the flow? Like, you catching bass, you catching panfish? Is it one of them things where you're just kind of, you know, I know the sandy rivers that we have here, when the water's low, the fishing is basically hopping from kind of sandbar to sandbar and just fishing them outside bends where it's undercut and you got some deeper water and you're just trying to hit the pools, you know, here and there. Like, it's very much just hopping from spot to spot instead of being able to fish continuously all the way down the bank. Is that kind of what y'all got over there?
Yeah, on those outside bends, it'll be a little bit deep. And then, I don't know, that we have, they call it like soapstone down here, and it gets kind of channelized. Like, you'll have these real deep channels and all the water will be going through that channel as opposed to being spread out. And, fish will sit in those little deep channels, deep narrow channels as well. But I, for the past few weeks, prior to now, I kind of put down the bass stuff and have mostly been brim fishing. The brim will just sit, you know, in a couple of inches of water sometimes, and they seem pretty hungry right now. As soon as like a little popper or a beetle spin hits the water, they're usually taking it. So the past few weeks, I've been more so brim fishing, like I said, in those little narrow deep channels or on those outside bends, and yeah, not a whole lot of bass fishing. The bass fishing, I think they just kind of get hunkered down in the deepest, coolest water they can find. And you have to fish real slow for them. And when I'm doing a float or something, I might, you know, you blow past those holes so quick that you don't get opportunity to really fish them. So I've mostly been brim fishing, but The bass bite is starting to pick back up here as well. With the water has cooled considerably over the past week or so, and I've seen that correlating to some good stuff for the bass as well.
Nice. Yeah, I know. I have thrown many a beetle spin and topwater popper, and the bluegill are really fun. I had a real good trip last week where I went out there and was nymphing for them under an indicator on some little undercut banks that had some cypress knees, and it was some really good action. And that, to be honest, is a pile of fun. I'll give you a tip too. When you're blowing past stuff in a canoe, the best thing that I've got for down here is a buddy turned me on to them years ago. They make those like spring-loaded clamp anchors, like brush anchors. And you go past that pool, and it kind of stinks because you're floating over the top of the pool, So like I've had them scenarios. Like you're talking about where, you blow past it, you float over it, and you're like, well, dang, like I don't want to fish a pool I just went over. But if you'll anchor up, if you get past it and anchor up, and if especially if it's shallow where you can wade, if you anchor up and just set a timer on your phone or your wristwatch, give them 10 minutes, drink a drink, eat a sandwich, chit chat, rig up, and they'll calm down, and you can fish them pools once you give them a second to settle down.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Now, is that the anchor you're talking about? Is that like a you push it down into the sand, or how? I'm not sure I've seen that. How does the anchor thing work?
I've got a sand spear too, and those work good. But no, this is a clip. It's
Oh,
really
okay.
hard to describe. It's almost like a spring loaded thing. But once you get it around, it'll clip on a little piece of brush. If you got a tie-tie or yaupon bush growing out on the edge of the water, or if there's a cypress knee that you can clip to, we got a lot of them down here. Just a root sticking out of the bank, like just something there to hold your canoe, keep it from floating away from you while you float downstream, or a sometimes down here, I was out there last weekend and had my kayak and was using the kayak to get over the deep holes. I was fishing upstream, and you paddle over the deep holes and get to the spot where you could wade. And I was just clipping the kayak to me with a D-ring,
Okay.
three or
Yeah, I
four
think
foot
I
of
know what you're
rope
talking
on it and
about.
tying it. Yeah. But yeah, them little brush anchors like that, those are super handy, and they don't take up any room. Like that's always my thing. You try to tote a sand spear or a mushroom anchor, and it's just oof, like it's just one more thing in a boat. Or I know you do a stand-up paddle board, and now for a stand-up paddle board, I do like my sand spear. I don't know why I like it more on a stand-up paddle board than I do a canoe, but those are nice. If you don't
Yeah.
have one, that's a nice tool to have.
Yeah, I gotta look into something because I don't know what I've been doing. Most of the deep holes, with it being as hot as it's been, I get to them and float over them, and then I figure the fish already see me, and I just jump in it and swim around a little bit. But probably is scaring a few fish out of there for sure.
Hey, sometimes now you got to do that. I'll take trips. Usually my first float, I'm not bashful at all. I'll get out there and wade up to my neck and swim around and poke around with the paddle. And I tell you something else that's awesome if you're doing the low budget wading and float trips is I borrowed a friend's. I thought they were silly, and but I borrowed one to scout a local farm pond. And those castable sonars are pretty awesome. Like if you get them deep holes and you're like, well, I wonder just how deep that hole is and if it has structure and if it has fish, they're really accurate. Like comparing a Garmin castable to, the Garmin, I got a Garmin Striker 7. And obviously your screen is smaller, but they do a real good job as far as to seeing depth and structure and weeds and all the information's right there, and it's size of a softball. You got that in your cell phone, and heck, on them creeks, you can toss one out by hand and just toss it and let it drift, toss it and let it drift, and you can map them deep holes. It's pretty. They're pretty cool for 150, $200. They're not that expensive, and they're super cool.
Yeah, I've seen some videos of those. I'll have to look into that more. I never even considered that, but I can see how that'd be helpful. Yeah.
Oh, they're worth it. You can tow them behind your kayak. I've done that before. Tow one behind a kayak and just have your phone up there on the dash reading stuff. But tell me, what's it look like as you start cooling down? You talking about how bass are hunkered down right now. When do y'all really start getting y'all's fall bass bite?
I'll get into that too, but real quick before we go away from the drought stuff. I found One kind of tip on how to find some cooler running water, even in the midst of a drought like we've been having here. We haven't got rain here in a month at least, so everything's real low. But it sounds a little sketchy, but if you can find a stream that's like the discharge for a water treatment plant or facility, we have one here that the city of Dothan pumps their water through. So whatever water is being used in the city of Dothan ends up going back into that stream and later into the Chattahoochee. And even when the Chattahoochee is like barely moving, just like a old mud puddle out there, this stream has a continuous flow and the water stays cool. Now, some people might feel a little bit weird about wading around in treatment water, but if you've been on any of the major rivers, that's basically where that water comes from too. So if you can find a stream that where that city water is getting pumped back out in, that's a good way to find something if you're doing floats and stuff. That's kind of what where I've been fishing a good bit through the past few weeks, just so there's at least a little bit of water flowing.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. People down here fish what they call the hot ditch, which is the discharge from a Barry steam plant. And when they get done with that water, it's warmer, and in the wintertime, that's where all the fish pile up. But it's also in our case, if you're fishing there close to Barry, you got some really, really high mercury levels that the Department of Public Health reports. And so you definitely got to watch that. Got to watch the wading. I do some wading in some little streams in Mobile. And there's one of them that as you're wading, I mean, you can see the sewage in infrastructure, sewer infrastructure. And so you gotta watch that. You don't want to be wading that in the summertime after a heavy rain would, open sores on your leg
Definitely,
or
yeah.
anything. And I wouldn't want to eat fish. But yeah, it'll stuff like that, temperature changes and current, however it gets made, right? It's like downstream of a dam. People love to fish tailwaters, but a tailwater below a dam, that's not a natural feature, but it still holds fish.
It just creates a different opportunity and, something different that the fish can kind of hone in on when it's dry and everything. But yeah, I just wanted to mention that because it's kind of been a hack for me finding some water that's still moving. But as far as that fall bite, the northern part of the state, I would assume is probably already starting to get that for the past few weeks. I saw it got down to somewhere in the low 60s up there, like near Birmingham. But obviously down here, like Dothan, west over to Mobile, it's a little bit warmer still. But that water within the past week is starting to feel significantly cooler. And I actually went out this morning and fished some top water and caught a couple of really nice largemouth out of a pretty small creek. So that's definitely a change from what's been going on. A few weeks ago, throwing the top water, I wouldn't have imagined I would have got anything. But right about now, where are we at? Like the last week of August, I would say is pretty much getting to that point where you can start seeing the bass be more aggressive and key in on things like crankbaits or spinner baits or top water lures.
Well, it's gonna be exciting. I know. I was just talking last week with Peter Jordan about fall fishing, and that's something I'm looking forward to doing this year. I haven't done it a bunch in the past. I've always been that guy who puts down a rod and picks up a bow. But Taylor, I know you were saying earlier that you were fishing for panfish and you were using beetle spins. You're talking about switching over to the bass and them chasing crankbaits and spinner baits. Do you throw the bigger, like 1/4 ounce beetle spins? Do you have a downsize like a Pond Magic spinner bait that you like to use, or are you just throwing regular old, 1/2 ounce spinner baits like the guys out on the big lakes?
Yeah, man. So I do go with larger beetle spins too for the bass. Now I usually just take a ultralight spinning setup out there when I fish. So I'll just have like a little 5.5, 6 foot like crappie rod and a little 1,000 size reel. So I wouldn't necessarily be able to get away with like a 1/2 ounce spinner, but I think those beetle spins that I usually throw are about an eighth of an ounce is the biggest I'll go, and that gets plenty deep for the little creeks and rivers that I'm fishing. So I'll throw that beetle spin, and then the one that I really like for bass, I believe it's a Strike King, and I think they call it like a micro spinner or a micro series spinner. You can get them at like Walmart or Academy for, like $2, $3. But yeah, I'll throw those. I think those are an 1/8 ounce as well, and do really good with the bass. Now down here, our water is, it's not muddy, but it's just a little bit darker with like some of those tannins in the water. So I really like a black and blue spinner, or like a white and chartreuse, but that black and blue is really my go-to. So yeah, usually 1/8 ounce is like the ticket for me as far as bass fishing with spinners goes in smaller creeks and rivers.
You talk about fishing kind of some stained or muddy water, and I know exactly the little Strike King, Micro Kings that you're talking about, and I've fished them too, and they're a slightly bigger beetle spin almost, but they have, instead of the little hairpin thing where your ball jig head attaches, like that's cool to swap stuff out, but they're not near as hang free, as the other stuff. So I like the ones you're talking about, but they're, for me at least, they're hard to find. They have a silver spoon. I really like a gold spoon, and it may just be in my head, but in dingy water, I like a gold spoon. And if you like to throw an 1/8 ounce spinnerbait, you should check out, I don't know if they sell them where you're at because you're further inland, but down here, all the Walmarts will have the 1/8 ounce Redfish Magic. And the Redfish Magic baits are basically a bigger beetle spin. And they come with a Z-Man diesel minnow, like a paddle bait as a trailer. And dude, those are awesome. I've caught everything down here: specks, reds, bass, bowfin, gar, catfish. Like, if you don't have them, let me know next time I'm over that way. I'll bring you six of them because that's one of my favorite baits. Like, they got a big fat Colorado blade. It makes a lot of vibration and has some good flash, and it really slows down. It just doesn't sink any. It's an 1/8 ounce head, and them Z-Man baits float a little bit, and then that big Colorado blade hovers it, so you can fish that thing 6 inches below the surface of the water if you want to, or you can let it sink, so you can kind of cover the whole water column in small water. It's a fun bait.
Yeah, I've never seen those here. I guess we're just far enough inland where we don't have any of that inshore or saltwater stuff. So
Oh,
I'll have to check those out. I've never seen them.
you're missing out. I'll bring you some, and then you'll have something that everybody else isn't throwing up there. They won't have seen that before. They've all them bass up there have probably seen the Rebel Crick Hoppers and the little Storm swim baits and the Crim worms and everything. All the standard Walmart tackle, they've seen that, but they haven't seen the Redfish Magic. You get them with that.
There you go.
There we go. Well, tell me too. I know I was just seeing on your Facebook post, if you want to talk about it, and I know they're rare and you may or may not want to talk about it, but you had a pretty exciting sturgeon encounter a while back too.
Yeah, man. So me and my buddy were floating from up kind of north of Dothan down to a town called Clayhatchie, which is about parallel with Dothan. So at least 20 miles north of the state line, maybe a little bit further. And we saw a pair of sturgeon, a big one. I say the big one, not a stretch to say it was over 3 feet, maybe like 4 foot. It was big. And then we saw a smaller one. So I would imagine that they were up there spawning. It was kind of in a, you had fished there before. It's a shallow, sandy area, the Chota-Hatchee. And that was my first time seeing one in that shallow of water. And we were actually like kind of following it around, filming it, and knee deep clear water. You could see it, like it has these big like armor plates on it, and they kind of have like a pinkish red tinge to them. So that was really awesome to see. I've seen them before lower in the Chota-Hatchee in Florida, where they're doing that thing where they jump out of the water, but that was my first time seeing one this far upstream. So that's exciting to see that the Chota-Hatchee seems to be healthy enough where they still want to run up there and spawn. So yeah, that was exciting. That was fun to see.
Yeah, I'm super jealous. We don't really have that down here where you can see them. We get, some cool fish that we get to watch run for their spawn. Like, we get red horse suckers up in the tributary up here. So you do get to watch, at least a spawning run. But man, Super jealous, man. You got a special place over there. I mean, so I appreciate you talking about it. I feel like that corner of the state is a real sleeper, you know, everybody up in the Piedmont and the Appalachians, you know, like that's talked about. The Tennessee River gets talked about down here on the coast gets talked about, but that little corner that you're in is pretty nice. So it's always good to hear what's going on out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick before we wrap up too, just talking about water quality and having those sturgeon up there. Michael Mullen with the Chattahoochee River Keeper, I think he's doing an awesome job with the River Keeper stuff over here too, just fighting for us to have good water quality. And he's been doing some stuff recently with the PFAS contamination and, you know, fighting to get some of that stopped from getting into our stream. So for anybody over here, you know, in this region of the Wiregrass, check him out on Facebook, the Chattahoochee River Keeper, and, you know, consider either going out to one of his like cleanups where they clean up some of the access points, or maybe make it a donation if you know, have a few extra bucks, because I think he's doing a lot of that out of his own pocket, just doing that testing and stuff. So I just wanted to, you know, shout him out and thank him for all that he's doing as far as water quality goes over here.
No, for sure. I'm glad that you brought that up because yeah, we've had a lot of the river keepers on. I need to have a conversation with him because I've noticed on Facebook a lot of the stuff he's posting, water quality updates and stuff like that. And that's definitely doing good work. You know, that's we need that, you know, and I'm glad that y'all got, you know, for the most part, you know, y'all's watershed seem to be doing pretty good, but it's good to have somebody keeping an eye on them, you know, reporting issues and holding people accountable when they mess with that, because it's a really important resource, man. Alabama's really got something special, and I feel like sometimes people don't do a good enough job. Feel like people don't know about it, and you know, not always do the best job taking care of it. So it's good to see people setting just a great example. I've noticed that a lot here this summer, him posting about the stuff they're doing over there.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, man, thanks for having me on. Always happy to talk about what's going on over here. We haven't got our fishing trip together yet, but if you ever, you know, head out this way, definitely let me know and I'll show you some of the stuff that I come on here and talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We'll make it happen.
All right, man. Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by. Did you know every 40 seconds someone has a heart attack or stroke? In that moment, every second counts and every critical decision matters. Air Medcare Network's air ambulance providers can bring life-saving care directly to those in need at a moment's notice. With 320 locations across 38 states, Air Medcare is the largest air ambulance network. Rest assured, they've got you and your entire household covered. Membership is just $99 a year or just $79 for seniors. Visit gdo.com/airmedcare to enroll. All righty, guys, welcome back for this segment. We're talking with Will Strickland, Executive Director of Mobile Bay Keeper. Will, I just got a super snazzy magazine in the mail today that I've been thumbing through on my lunch break. Currents is looking good, other than that one Nick Williams fella that y'all keep letting write for him. I liked all the other articles.
Yeah. Well, we got to do something to keep that audience up there in North Baldwin County engaged. So we let one of their native sons write for us. But no, man, I appreciate you saying that. I'd love to take more credit for what a quality magazine it is. But that's Kane O'Rear, a former journalist and magazine extraordinaire. So he does a great job, and it's been a great tool for people to understand the voice of the water of coastal Alabama.
There we go. Yeah, it's man, it really warms the cockles of my heart to get that Currents magazine and see that Poland skiff on there and hear people talk about Jimbo Mador and see Peter Jordan in there, and then you know, showing up at the town halls, seeing the commercial and the recreational fishermen like that. That's super encouraging to me because I know that hasn't always been, you know, the case. Like I know the first time, I mean, you've had this conversation before, but when I first went to public hearing on the coal ash issue, I guess it's been about 4 years ago, there was not a lot of anglers. So it's been really good to kind of see bay keepers make inroads with that community. Like I'm really happy to see that. Give me just a quick rundown. What have y'all been up to here since we last talked?
Yeah, well, we've been in the news a little bit, so I'm sure some of your listeners have seen some of it. But I mean, it ultimately comes back to community, which is what you referenced before. And as an angler, somebody who grew up doing it, and having a grandfather that was, in a union at a tire manufacturing company, and he took us coon hunting. We'll get more into that. But the origin of all of our work starts with the community, right? So these commercial fishermen that you've been seeing at these town halls, they came to us. I mean, have been coming to us for years. But when I started about 3 years ago, a few of those guys reached out and asked, what are we going to do about dredge material being put into Mobile Bay? And so that's been the big headline for us. And so we are attempting to get the Corps of Engineers to do something different with their dredge material because they're dumping quite a bit of it into Mobile Bay. And that's harming our native grasses and other small organisms, oysters included, that those fish that we love to catch and eat rely on. So that's a brief summary of that. We got plenty going on over here as well, as we're partnering with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers on a cleanup here soon. So y'all can look out for that coming up, and expect more partnership there with BHA. I don't know how much your listeners are engaged, but that's a great group. It's something I got involved in with when I lived out west.
Yeah, I'm going to be looking forward to that event. The cleanup area for the local guys down here, the old ghost fleet track off the Mobile Tensaw Delta. Awesome opportunities, but man, that's just one of those places that unfortunately is just a magnet for dumping everything from old refrigerators, old John boots to just, gut buckets, beer cans. I don't know how, but it all makes its way down there. So it'll be nice to get that cleaned up.
I was saying between us and DCNR's involved and BHA, we're gonna have the equipment and the manpower to get some of those refrigerators and tires and all that stuff that folks think it's okay to dump in the woods out of there. So look for a high poundage at this upcoming cleanup.
There's definitely it would be nice. I know that you have some like fishing tournaments that do like a trash pickup, division. And yeah, I know where some stuff is where I could round the weight up if I just felt like doing it. There's a
That's the part of the secret of cleanups. You get in those areas where they got that heavy stuff, you can
that's
blow it
it.
out of the water. So
That's it,
this will be
man.
one of those, I expect.
Well, let's circle back to this. I know me and you've talked about it a little bit. I don't know that we've covered it on the show, but you were talking about coon hunting, and I know I've got some family from kind of the same neck of the woods you're talking about, like over there on the Tom Bigbee and Black Warrior watersheds. I've actually got family out in Foster's, Alabama, and you talk about coon hunting and crappie fishing out there, and I spent some time there this summer knocking out some counties on my fly fishing challenge, and I've got a few more to do out there in kind of West Central Alabama. Give me some more background. Your granddaddy sounds like an interesting man. Like he seems like my kind of people.
Well, so I had two grandfathers that were involved at different levels in my life. The one that I'm named after, he went by Bill Strickland out of Tuscaloosa. He was very civically involved and a leader in the community. And not that these things are mutually exclusive, but on the weekends we were down in Sumter County or Gordo and Pickens County, and or out on the Tom Bigbee or the Black Warrior. We were out in the woods. That's what he did. That's where he found his peace. And not only did being a civically engaged person, not only did we hunt and fish, but he of course had to be involved with the Ducks Unlimited and National Wild Turkey Federation, Alabama Wildlife Federation. So I grew up going to all those banquets and wild game cook-offs, and he was in the printing business, so he did printing for all those groups in that area. But I'll never forget fishing with him, crappie fishing there on the Black Warrior. And the Ten Tom down there south of Demopolis, and but we didn't eat the fish that came out of the Black Warrior. We'd eat the fish out of Lake Tuscaloosa or some of the smaller creeks, Bodka Creek over in Sumter County, something like that. But and it wasn't that we were heeding some fish consumption advisory that was made public. It was that he knew what went on upstream. The paper mill was still fresh in people's minds in Tuscaloosa. I think it had closed before I come around, but there were other activities that were going on upstream, and being the wise grandfather that he was, he would relate that to being a good neighbor. And so he would talk about it as a metaphor, but a reality for us is that what happens upstream of here comes downstream to others. And so we have to be thoughtful about what we're doing in the actions of our day-to-day life and how it affects others. And so the golden rule was the main rule for him, but it related to whether or not we were able to eat the crappie. So that's what I grew up doing. Cane poles for brim, crappie, things like that. We got into some running trot lines for catfish. And my dad was a big bass fisherman who and I loved that. He was a fiend when he was younger, and he did all kind of fishing all over. But by the time he had kids, we would go catch bass there in local ponds. So that's my dad's side of the family, and I'll get in a little bit more of that. But my mom's side of the family, my mom's dad, he was a wild one. He was the one that worked at B.F. Goodrich and was in the union, and but he lived out in the country. He lived in Pickens County. So he had a blue tick hound that my mom had given him, and he loved to fish. He was mainly a bass fisherman by the time I came around, but I certainly heard stories of what was going on before that, where he used some extra legal practices to gain some access to fish and things like that. Being a guy that lived out in Pickens County, he did what he could get. But man, we had a great time, and so you can see the legacy of having both sides of the family. Two different perspectives, backgrounds, professions, but it was the same thing. What are we going to do to connect with our family? What are we going to do to connect with creation? We're going to go out in it. We're going to figure out where those fish are, where those deer are, turkey, or coons, or whatever. We're going to interact with it. And I have found that there's those that love these different species of animals, but also they end up loving the land. The plants, the soils, they know more about it than folks that just love it for what it is based on principle because they know these creatures. And so I had two grandfathers that knew that and were able to pass that along to me.
It sounds like a pretty good upbringing. I mean, that's an awesome part of the world. Talked about Pickens and Sumter County. I did years ago. I broke out a spreadsheet and just started tracking deer kills per capita. Got to looking at the old Alabama whitetail records back when you could still access those. I don't know what happened to that organization, but I pulled up Boone and Crockett and Pope and Young, and I very quickly realized that if you're going to deer hunt in Alabama, there's two places to be. You wanted to be up on the Tennessee River Valley, or you wanted to be Pickens, Sumter, Greene, that part of the world right there, touching Mississippi on that black belt. And then, the waters, man, are awesome too, especially like you talk about getting up there around Demopolis, where the Black Warrior and the Tombigbee come together. I've spent a fair bit of time up there, a little bit of hunting and a little bit of fishing. And I mean, all the boat ramps are good. Like, and you catch fish just right there at the boat ramp. Like, there's some awesome bank fishing opportunities up there. You know, like you get your boat and you want to go out there and fish, but man, driving up there, you can hammer fish right there off of a boat ramp. Just a nice place.
It is. I wish I could say I contributed to some of that data for Boone and Crockett and whatever for killing big deer, but we got after them. And I think the diversity of landscape is something that's special, in my opinion, about West Alabama. You know, we go up north, not far at all, up into Fayette and Walker counties, and you've got, you know, rocks. That's what I say. I miss rocks sometimes living down here on the coast and waterfalls and cliffs and clear small streams that are running rapid sometimes, and so you get a particular kind of fish in there, and then you got the Sipsey Swamp, or I mean it's the Sipsey River, which people often confuse with the Sipsey Fork. So if you hadn't made that distinction before, let me do it. Is that those are two different rivers. The Sipsey Fork goes into the Black Warrior, and the Sipsey River goes into the Tombigbee, and it's a slow moving swampy river. You can hunt ducks out of there. And then I grew up in a similar type of environment in Sumter. We called it the Swamp Club. And then you have these big, massive rivers like the Tombigbee or the Black Warrior, and that are moving a lot of water, a lot of sediment. And that's where we're fishing on the bottom for catfish and things like that, or finding a few spots. And that's the thing about both my grandfathers is they go to a spot that they fished at when they were a boy, and there'd be crappie right there. You know, it's that's on the White Warrior side of things. The tent making of the 10 Tom, I hear lots of whining about how the old fishing holes aren't the same anymore. So that sticks out in my mind.
I know the 10 Tom has been controversial for decades. You talk about the Sipsey versus the Sipsey Fork. So I got that education last year, I believe. One of our writers, Dave Strickland, he invited me up there to fish a stretch that he's been fishing since he was a kid. I mean, he's been fishing up there for, 50 years or better. Grew up fishing there with his cousins, and I thought I was familiar with the Sipsey Fork, and then we ended up on Sipsey River, fishing for Alabama bass out of a canoe that he was towing behind a soft top Jeep. Like, just super, super cool trip. David is a great guy, and it was just my kind of trip, towing a square stern canoe back in the woods. But yeah, it was like I had drove 4 or 5 hours just to end up right back in my backyard. You're right. I mean, it's a very slow moving, swampy, hardwood bottoms, jumping wood ducks out of the cypress knees type scenario. But then, like you said, in that area of the state, you can pop over and be on, whatever they call that Bankhead Plateau or whatever. And that's a completely different world. But then you're not that far away. You can poke around and find Blackwater Creeks, and then of course you have the actual Black Belt where you can still see here and there glimpses of the old prairie habitat. So it's a cool place. There's a lot of opportunities up there. And I've done some hunting on the 10 Tom on the core land, and getting off on some of them islands that they made with some of that dredge spool. There's so much stuff to do. You could spend your whole life and just never see it all.
Well, I mean, as I was going to say, it was good enough that I didn't even know there were rivers and land out in East Alabama. You know, we stuck to West Alabama, and then occasionally we come down here to the coast on vacation and fish Bonsecours and things like that. But I didn't know nothing about the Coosa River Valley and all it has to offer, the Tallapoosa, none of that. So I do remember one trip to a section of the Alabama River in between Claiborne and Miller's Ferry, because that's a legendary place in my father's eyes, where claims to have heard a mountain lion right there when he was, 18, 19, something like that, out there. Maybe there might have been some other influences on his mind at the time, I'm unsure, but he claims he heard that distinct scream of a mountain lion right there in the Alabama River.
Hey, it wouldn't surprise me, man. That stretch is there's some really good fishing there in those impoundments, and then the deer hunting is really great, and that's a wild enough area of the state. Wouldn't surprise me if one made its way up out of Florida. And that is my understanding, that we do occasionally get a solitary male or something that'll make a little trip. We don't have a breeding population, but from what I hear, we get a straggler here and there. So
I was just going to say, keep the legend alive. Whatever we got to do, even if it ain't true, we got to keep that legend alive. So I'm
that's
for
it.
it.
That's it. Tell me a little bit more. I think it's fascinating, like you talk about your granddad being involved in, National Wild Turkey Federation, Ducks Unlimited, being civically minded, and then, being cognizant, even without there being guidelines and fish consumption advisories. Like, just that's awesome to me that you had somebody who back then was like, yeah, like, just not sure about eating fish downstream of a paper mill. Do you think that kind of kickstarted your environmental career? Like, that early exposure, that mindset of like, hey, what ends up in the water ends up in the fish and ends up in you. You need to think about that.
It most certainly did. You do a lot of this deciding that in hindsight, however. So it wasn't, it's not just that, hey, this fish has toxics in it, it ends up in your body, but it's I think the biggest thing is being oriented towards your fellow man. That's the biggest takeaway from my grandfather, and he was a small business owner, but he did so much for the Kiwanis Club and others that it was, for me, I had this passion instilled in me for justice, for understanding and helping your fellow man. And so I went to school at University of Alabama, just like my grandfather, my parents did, and my grandmother as well. She was in childhood early childhood development. which is another thing that had passed on to me. And I was going to be an engineer. I didn't really think about it. I was playing football, so I didn't think much about the school part of things, but I was good enough at math, and my parents were pretty involved in saying, hey, you're going to be an engineer. So I didn't think much about it. And then I learned year two or three that there is this thing called environmental engineering with a focus on surface water. And that got me excited because now not only can I use some of my math skill sets and make a living, but I could save the world while I'm doing it because I knew a lot of these issues that we are talking about, whether it be toxics in the water or, as we mentioned, the construction of the Tin Tom and how that affected the fishery and things like that. So I got that's the path I went for the undergraduate degree and got out of school and went to work as an engineer. And I remember having these conversations with my grandfather because when you're in a, we were a consulting company, did a lot of good things, but we were working for whoever our client was, right? And so there were times where we were doing engineering or being expert witnesses in a lawsuit or something like that on things that I didn't think were quite right. They weren't moving the needle the right way. And he gave me some good advice to, you've got to be able to make a living for your family, but you've got to work, put your hand towards work at something that's within your values. And so I ended up leaving that job. My best friend at the time was a missionary in China. And so I wanted to do that. I just got married and my wife wasn't ready for us to move full time. So we spent a summer in Eastern Europe and then ended up spending the majority of the next 3 years in South Asia. So India, Nepal, Bangladesh, places like that. And by the way, just a note on that, Bangladesh, they got a tremendous tourist opportunity, in my opinion. More ducks than you'll ever see in your life. The whole country is basically one big swamp, man. And you go out there's ducks all over the place because nobody's out there with a shotgun taking them. Anyway, back to the story. I ended up leading an organization that through the church-based organizations was doing poverty alleviation around the world. It's called Mission One, and I moved to Phoenix, Arizona. That's where all my children were born. But I combination of different things, but one of the big ones is my grandfather passed away. And so I started, as one does, contemplating what am I supposed to be doing with my life? I know I'm trying to do good, working for my fellow man. We're in the middle of COVID right thereafter, and the world was on fire. We were doing everything we could to help. But my heart was being brought back to the water. And my opinion, God's charge of man to also take care of the rest of creation. And I was actually in seminary at the time. I was writing some papers about it. Anyway, through all that contemplation, an opportunity came up to come down here to Mobile Bay. And it excited me for a lot of reasons, but the idea of honoring my grandfather's legacy, being able to provide that service to my fellow man, to the rest of creation, it just felt right. And so I'm super grateful to be in this position. There's some other interesting notes there. I've started some papers. This was before I lived here on the Choctaw Nation and kind of an imagined fiction, historic fiction of what their legends could look like being told out in today's world, especially as it relates to water quality and things like that. But nevertheless, those are coincidences. But I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be able to hear the folks of Coastal Alabama and try to help them meet their needs and their desires for what they want their water bodies and hunting land to be.
Definitely an interesting story. It's cool to hear, like, start off in West Alabama and travel the world and end up bouncing right back to where you were. On a side note, I'm gonna have to peruse these papers at some point. I'm gonna have to get a sneak peek at them because I know I've always been big in mythology and folklore, and it's hard to get into. Unfortunately, that's a whole other can of worms. It's its own separate.
Yeah,
That's not its
yes,
own separate show. That's its own separate, like, podcast series talking about
that's right.
Native American folklore. But man, like the old stories that you hear down here, like the Ukutena, like the horned serpents and stuff like that. Like, that's I've been diving into that. Like, I'd love to see all of that put together in an anthology. Like,
That's
anybody,
right.
if you know anybody who's doing that work, let me know. I'll start the GoFundMe for them. Like, I'll support that. That's awesome.
I'll add to that. Yeah, let Nick know. You got his contact information, but I'm on board. There's so many keys to success hidden in people that have been in a place for a long time. You know, we're not to say that we don't become integrated, but you know, my family from all over Europe ended up in all kind of different ports here into the United States, and so the legends that fit when they were living in Europe don't necessarily fit cleanly as they make a home here in Alabama or wherever else in the country we landed. And so there's so much wisdom, and of course we can apply science and data and all kinds of things to those legends and often figure out why were those stories being told? What was the purpose? What sort of protection to the people and to the water and the land? And Nick, if you've got any more of those resources, send them my way because they do seem to be sparse, especially on the internet. You gotta drive up and talk to somebody that's been a part of the tribe to get a lot of that information.
Definitely. I have thought about that. It would definitely require some pretty intensive legwork, but then it's also, you know, the time to do it's now. Like I feel like you wait another generation and it gets harder, right? To track all that stuff down. That's interesting that we have that shared interest. I know we've shared some mornings in a duck blind and that's never come up before, but I had to keep that thread going just a little bit longer. That's awesome.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, you're right on the what we lose in each generation. You mentioned Jimbo Metter earlier, and so I want to pay my respects to Jimbo. He's a very good friend, and I get the opportunity to have breakfast with him regularly. He says a few things. They have a lot of wisdom. One of them is that each generation doesn't know what it's lost, and so it's because they never had it. So it's very important that we preserve these stories so that we can know what we're shooting for. And it's not that we're saying, hey, things ought to be in every way the way that it was, you know, and also that's not realistic, but rather understand the way in which this land has protected itself for thousands of years. You know, a guy that's in his 80s who lived it before we lost all our seagrasses, he's gonna be able to tell me about that. Stuff that I can't find in a research paper or in a data set. But he lived it. He knows that he spearfished in Mobile Bay. The folks can tell us all day that was never possible, but you're not gonna get him and others like him to believe it. So those are super important stories for all of us.
Yeah, it's I've never met him in person. It seems like he's friends with a lot of people I'm friends with. One of these days, maybe I'll sneak in there and grab a coffee with you. But
Yeah,
no,
man,
I'm reading
we'll make
about
it
him
happen.
in Thomas McWane's book, The Longest Silence. You know, it was very cool to me when I read that book to see a character from my neck of the woods. You know, like that. That's just something sometimes you don't see a whole lot, right? And they're like Alabama doesn't get a whole lot of representation in the literary world outside of, you know, Harper Lee, I guess. So
That's right.
it was cool to see a modern day living flesh and blood character there in a book of that caliber. Yeah, I like that quote that you don't know, each generation doesn't know what they're missing. It's something I think about a lot, you know, the playing on the sand dunes when I was a kid, like that's off the table for my daughter. And you know, got involved with bay keepers and backcountry hunters and anglers and other organizations because I'd like to be able to show her as much as I can and, you know, maybe reverse the trend and maybe her kids will be able to do something that was off the table for me. You know, like it'd be great if down the road that was a possibility and, you know, maybe you could go floundering again in Mobile Bay or go spear fishing. So I feel like that's for a lot of us, maybe for your granddaddy, maybe for you. I know for me, you know, kids are kind of your projection into the future. Like it makes it a lot easier for you to think about the next generation once you get skin in the game. And I know we've got a lot of dads out there listening to the podcast. If we got folks who are looking to kind of make that difference, what's some projects that Baykeepers has going on that they can help out with?
Yeah, I'm gonna frame this in with my kids. And so I've got three small kids, twin 5-year-old boys, 7-year-old girl, and I like to take them fishing as much as I can. That's an activity that's easy enough when they're this age, and we can put a bobber in a worm or a cricket or a shiner and throw it out there and see what happens. But and we've talked about this before, but one of the shames of it not too terribly different from me and my grandfather is most of the bodies of water where I'm taking my kids to fish have advisories that say don't eat any fish from this body of water. And of course, I dig into that data a little bit more in my day job. And so I know what's behind those advisories. And it doesn't mean that we don't ever eat any fish. And it doesn't mean that we don't ever eat a fish occasionally from a body of water that might have an advisory on it, to be honest with you. However, that's going to stop for me as cancer's affected my family. And I won't dig much deeper into it than that. This is something that all of us anglers should be concerned about is what's going into our bodies, what's going into to the fish that we catch. And so whether or not you're eating your catch, you are exposed to the heavy metals and chemicals, the known carcinogens that we dump at rates that, in my opinion, are unacceptable into our waterways. And so here in the next few months, there'll be our state will publish its annual toxics data, and we'll make that information available to everybody, and along with some information about how our standards are woefully lower than the federal recommendations, which most states exceed those recommendations. That's something we should all be concerned about, whether you are eating fish you catch or not. And then also the issue of people having this knowledge. Again, I had a grandfather that was very thoughtful. He understood what was going on upstream. But just because our state is doing testing and issuing advisories, which we are grateful for, doesn't mean that your everyday person knows about it. And I've been to enough boat ramps and piers and people fishing on the causeway side of the road to know that the majority of folks don't know if their catch is safe to eat or not. So that's a fight that, I say a fight, that's an issue that we're all going to need to raise our voice and say, hey, we need to know, and we need to stop putting so many toxics in our waterways. And so your audience, I think, is primed to be that voice. One thing for it to come from the folks that are their day job is working on water quality, but it's something else entirely to do like my grandfather did and say, hey, I'm going to take time out of my day. I work a different job, but it matters enough to me to say, hey, we need to do something different. We need to change our toxics criteria, that's what it's called, which is basically the amount of toxic waste we're able to put into our rivers. So that's if you're looking for one thing to engage in, that would be the one for me. You can visit mobilebaykeeper.org to find more information about fish consumption advisories, where they are, and then what we can do about it. And you, if you go to mobilebaykeeper.org, it'll hit you fairly early on in the process to figure out where to go.
And we're going to take a quick break. Y'all take a minute to check out some of the businesses that keep this show free for you. This week's episode has been brought to you by Visit Mississippi. If you're looking for a beautiful state that's packed with outdoor attractions, check out Mississippi. Of course, you know about the Mississippi River, but there are lots of great rivers for paddling throughout the state. Coastal Mississippi's waters are perfect for deep sea fishing or exploring the state's 5 uninhabited barrier islands. You'll find national forests with campgrounds, trails and recreational sites, 25 parks, and wildlife management areas too. Whatever you like to do in the great outdoors, you can do in Mississippi, where wanderers are welcome. Plan your adventure at visitmississippi.org/outdoors. Bucks Island is a family-owned and operated business since 1948. They have new pontoon boats, bass boats, bow riders, and aluminum boats for sale. They love trade-ins for boats and motors. They can rig your boat or ship your new motor anywhere in the United States. They provide boat service on all kinds of boats, even if they weren't purchased from Bucks. They have factory-trained and certified technicians. Visit them at 4500 Highway 77, Southside, Alabama, 35907 zip code, or give them a call at 256-442-2588. All right, folks, that's going to wrap it up for this week. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And again, don't forget to text that code ALFFR to 779-345-2918. Again, just text ALFFR, that's Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, to 779-345-2918. Subscribe to our email list, and we'll send you the promo code via email. This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by BucksIsland.com. Bucks Island has been in business since 1948 for all of your new and used boat needs, as well as motor sales and service, and now they have a pro-level tackle store. Boat and motor trade-ins are welcome. Visit them online at BucksIsland.com or give them a call at 256-442-2588. Also by Fish Bites. Whether you're hitting the sand with set rigs or fishing the flats and marshes for speckled trout, redfish, and flounder, Fish Bites has something for you. Check out the full line of scented saltwater and freshwater baits at fishbites.com. Also brought to you by Killer Dock. Killer Dock combines durability, function, and design to uniquely upgrade your entire dock experience. Visit killerdock.com to see more.